Dispelling some myth surrounding this anniversary for pro-life. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principle Policy. And along with me today is my co-host, the Vice Chairman of our Institute, a fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Good. I'm glad we're doing this show. I love to dispel myths.
Yes, I know. That seems to be one of our both of our favorite pastimes. And Chuck, I want to talk because we're sitting here on what's just about the eve of the 39th observance of the United States Supreme Court decision in the case of Roe versus Wade, which, according to popular myth, legalized abortion in all 50 states in this union. Now, ladies and gentlemen, you may be sitting there saying, these guys have lost their mind. They've been inhaling too many car fumes or whatever it might be, because everybody knows that Roe v. Wade is the law of the land. Supreme Court said it, therefore it is. Chuck, I'm here to say, and I think you are too, from a constitutional perspective, that couldn't really be for. It's only because people have been ignorant of the way our government is structured, the way the structured, and the way cases are determined, that legal fiction has been allowed to be the standing precedent, or stare decisis, for going on 39 years. It's sad to think that for almost an entire biblical generation, we've been wandering around in the wilderness and taking as gospel something that is totally false.
And you faded for a second and you say that couldn't be further from the truth, and the truth part faded out. And that's absolutely correct. This is one of the places where Christians came to a fork in the road about 40 years ago, and they took the wrong branch. First of all, when they actually got to the fork, they were unconscious that there was a fork in the road. So they really kind of got drug along on the bus and didn't necessarily know that which way the bus was going. But the fact is that Christians have become ignorant of the fact that the Supreme Court can't and doesn't make law. And the fact
and that's
that the
exactly
Court,
what I was getting at.
The fact that our friend and colleague Michael Perutka has said many, many times, quoting someone else, it's not what you know, it's what you know that just ain't so. And this is one of those places where it's just what you know that just ain't so. And hopefully today we're going to dispel a little bit of that mythology, the fact that Supreme Court can't make law.
Well, you know, Chuck, I think we need to unpack this a little bit. Now, for those of you who are not aware of it, or I need a refresher course on it, in 1973, the United States Supreme Court gave a decision upon a case that came before them, I believe it was out of the state of Texas, called Roe versus Wade. And as we know now from later unfolding history, Roe was Norma McCorvey, who the pro-abortion forces in this country found someone to use as their person who had standing in order to bring a case against Wade, who was the Attorney General of Texas, in order to overturn the laws against abortion in the state of Texas. Now, when the Supreme Court made their ruling, and it was a split decision, that, first of all, Chuck, we have to unpack something for the ladies and gentlemen out here, that the Supreme Court is not the penultimate decider of what's law. As a matter of fact, in our Constitution, if you've ever listened to us, you know that Article 1, Section 1, which is the legislative branch, is spelled out that says that all lawmaking powers, all legislative authorities here invested in a Congress of the United States. So in other words, all the power to make law is with Congress, which are the elected officials in the House and the Senate in the United States. The Supreme Court is established in Article 3 of the Constitution, and they're not established with a lawmaking power. They're established with the power of review of cases that come before the courts, and those cases are to be weighed in light of whether or not they're constitutional. So it's the case that's always supposed to be weighed in light of the Constitution. Now, we can get into the background history a little bit, Chuck, and I know you have a good handle on this, where we went from a situation where the courts, early on when our courts were formed, actually looked at the cases before them and saw whether or not that they fit our United States Constitution's provisions. But at a point in the late 1800s, a new type of way of looking at the law came about, and that was called case law study.
Right, the case law approach.
Case law approach, which Harvard University, the dean of the Harvard Law School, a gentleman by the name of Christopher Columbus Langdell, who was a devotee of Charles Darwin's evolutionary theory in biology, decided, well, you know what? If it's good enough for biology, it's got to be good enough for the law. And so what he decided to do was to create an evolutionary approach to the law. And that's how we got case law studies, where we look at the previous cases and how they were decided and determined to judge how to determine a new set of facts before the court. It's purely based on evolutionary theory, and it's purely wrong. It's unjust. But
it has swamped the legal system in all but just a very few law schools, and even they have to acquiesce and do the thing where now students, instead of studying law books like Blackstone, which go to the basis of law, they now study case law. And so that is why you'll find constitutional attorneys, and you and I have talked to some of these people,
yes,
and who will openly admit to you, actually, I've never read the Constitution of the United States of America. And that's because they don't study it in constitutional law. And that's because what they study instead is case law.
No, we've had a change in the philosophy of law. Now, historically, when a case came before the United States Supreme Court, when that court made a ruling or a decision, that decision affected the parties in the case, the X versus Y. So X and Y would be the ones on whom the decision of the court would rest as to whether or not a law that was being challenged comported with the Constitution of the United States or violated it, or whether the actions or one of the actors was legal or not. That's how cases were decided up until we got into this whole change in the philosophy of law and we got into case law studies. And so now we have things, and you've heard it if you've paid any attention to what happened with many of the nomination hearings for the United States Supreme Court, and it could have been the Obama appointees, or the nominees, excuse me, the Bush nominees, the Reagan nominees, you name it. You always hear this question about whether or not they hold to a concept called stare decisis, which means let the decision stand. And what that gets down to is you will not challenge the body of case law that has come before your current case that's in front of you as a judge, but you will adhere to what previous judges have said. And you may allow it to evolve a little bit, you know, because you may want to like strike some new ground. But in the main, you won't try to overturn or overrule previous decisions of the court.
Yeah, and it's that activity is actually what's known as Fabianism, which is too complex to explain, but you may have heard of the Fabian socialists.
So basically what we're getting at is because of the change in the philosophy and how we go about it, whether we look at it as an individual case versus a body that is sacrosanct and that we can't touch or make any significant changes to, we also came up, our American jurisprudence has also come up with this concept, false as it is, that the decision of the United States Supreme Court becomes part of the organic law of the land, that it becomes binding not just on the two parties that are involved or on the single state actor that might be involved, but it becomes binding on the entire nation, because obviously now that it has entered into the rarefied presence of the rest of the precedents set by the August Court, then every lower court in the country must do obeisance to it, and therefore it is the law of the land. Now, Chuck, you and I both understand the Constitution to some extent, and I'm having a real hard time finding where it says that the decisions of the courts are the supreme law of the land. If I remember correctly, Article 6 of the Constitution says, this Constitution and the laws of the United States made in pursuance thereof, which means the laws made that adhere to the Constitution, and the only way you can adhere to the Constitution and make a law is if you are Congress, because that's the only body that has lawmaking authority. So to say that the decisions of the United States Supreme Court are the law, vast majority of the people of this country have just bought as gospel.
Yeah, exactly. What has happened is that something extra constitutional, a power that has been essentially seized by what can only be called constitutional adventurers in the courts, and that is the power to determine whether a law is constitutional or not. And that, like Barry said, that is not covered in anywhere in the United States Constitution. The only place where judges have original jurisdiction is in cases of ambassadors, or if the states sue one another, or if the states sue the federal government, or maritime law. There is a very express list of things wherein the Supreme Court has original jurisdiction, and in everything else, they only have appellate jurisdiction. And in fact, the Roe v. Wade finding was under that appellate jurisdiction power.
That's right.
Congress could very easily tomorrow pass a law that says Roe v. Wade is null and void, and the power to determine what a violent crime is returned to the states, and put a little codicil in the law that says, and the Supreme Court has no jurisdiction to find on anything having to do with this law, period. But, and Roe v. Wade is over.
Well, you know, Chuck, you anticipated where I was
and
going.
And how many times have we been called nuts for that?
Well, the point is you anticipated where I was heading to, and that's it. That's just it, ladies and gentlemen. He's absolutely correct. And it wouldn't be unique, and it wouldn't be a rare... Well, Chuck, you really anticipated where I was heading to with this whole conversation today, and that was the fact that the decisions of the United States Supreme Court, by our Constitution, only affect the parties in the conflict, and therefore, for the courts to say that it's the law of the land, for the people to say it's the law of the land, is all false. Now, you mentioned a procedure that is found in our Constitution, and that is the limitation of the court's jurisdiction. Congress does have the authority under our Constitution to tell any of the federal courts, including the United States Supreme Court, if the particular authority of the court is not enumerated in Article 3 of the Constitution, and there are certain types of cases where the courts either have original or appellate jurisdiction, but abortion jurisprudence is not in either list. And as a matter of fact, it's not rare, and it's been used a number of times. Most recently, I believe it was a number of years ago when then-Senator Tom Daschle utilized this power of Congress to tell the federal courts that they couldn't hear any cases that had to do with the taking of timber in the state of South Dakota. Basically just told the federal courts, you have no jurisdiction over anything having to do with that where timber rights are involved. You're out of it. And do you know what? The courts to this day have been out of issues regarding timber rights in South Dakota. That's all it takes, ladies and gentlemen. Instead of us waiting for the Messiah in black robe and getting just the right president to appoint just the right justices to overturn Roe versus Wade, and therefore and being that abortion on demand in all 9 months is legal, all we need is to vote in a handful of committed, constitutionally educated congresspeople who are willing to go to the mat to press for the limitation of the federal courts in relation to anything dealing with abortion. If it has to do with a life issue, the taking of an unborn, defenseless human life, the federal courts have no authority to play in it whatsoever. And you know what? The courts have no recourse. If Congress passes this and pass it, and all it is a little rider that could be stuck at the end of almost any bill, and the president sign it, the courts have no constitutional authority to come back and say, well, that's not constitutional. You can't do that. They're muted at that point. They cannot. They cannot respond to it. It is one of the most effective checks on the power of a runaway judiciary, or as many people have coined it over the last 30 to 40 years, an imperial judiciary that our founders have left us in the Constitution. But it takes a committed, principled, conscientious, cognizant, educated member of Congress to do this. Ladies and gentlemen, we spent almost an entire biblical generation decrying the loss of life. We've seen over 50 million unborn babies slaughtered in this country. It's time we stop the madness. Instead of worrying about who we're electing president and whether or not they're going to appoint justices to the United States Supreme Court, hey, we know. We've looked back over the last 35 years. Every justice that even the most conservative of presidents have appointed have all been asked the same question and have all responded in the same way. Will you uphold the doctrine of stare decisis? Oh, yes, you know I will. Absolutely. Without a doubt. It is sacrosanct to me. I will uphold the previous rulings of the court. Ladies and gentlemen, we're not going to get a pro-life court. As long as they're going to uphold stare decisis, that means they're going to uphold Roe v. Wade, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, and a myriad of other cases. They're going to uphold
Until we get a new Senate, we will not get decent Supreme Court justices.
That's absolutely the case, ladies and gentlemen, because the Senate does the nominating. But the point is, we don't even have to have good Supreme Court justices. We could have 9 Sonia Sotomayors, 9 Ruth Bader Ginsburgs on the court. If Congress says you have no authority to hear cases regarding abortion jurisprudence, our problems are all but solved, because then it's at the state level, and it's at the state level where the voice of the pro-life community can be made to hear the loudest, can have the most impact upon the decisions of those lower courts. And we know that there are a number of states, take Mississippi, for example, or other states where they're strongly pro-life to the core. Those you can get decisions that overturn bad precedent where the taking of innocent human life or defenseless human life has been made quote unquote legal. And I use that term loosely because
I have to break in because we are vastly out of time.
Way out of time. Well, we need to come back tomorrow because there's a little bit more we need to talk about to get people ready as they hop on the buses to head to D.C. to go march in the January weather in Washington, talking about why we need a new Supreme Court. We need to give them some education on other things they should be doing.
Join us tomorrow for another Principles and Policies.